Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Memorial Day, the past and the present. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Memorial Day began after the Civil War. It was started by Southern women, mourning what they called the Lost Cause, the Confederacy. When the Northern states got into the act, it was all about commemorating the soldiers who died for the Union Army. On To the Point, we'll bring the history up to the present holiday, which is also about barbecues, three-day weekends, and the beginning of summer. Does America do a good job of remembering war dead? What about grieving families and veterans? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the GI Bill and the presidential campaign. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney back with To the Point. Memorial Day began after the Civil War, which killed 600,000 Americans, North and South. But the first day of remembrance wasn't really about them. The latest historical update comes from Carolyn Janey, assistant professor at Purdue University. She's author of Burying the Dead, But Not the Past, Ladies Memorial Associations and the Lost Cause. Professor Janey, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Who were the Ladies Memorial Associations and what was the Lost Cause?
Well, the Ladies Memorial Associations were middle and upper class white women in the South, women who, during the Civil War, had supported the Confederate war effort through ladies' aid societies, doing things like rolling bandages for the soldiers or perhaps volunteering in hospitals. And immediately after the Civil War, many of these associations transferred their work and their concentration onto the dead Confederates. Their primary responsibility and their primary reason for organizing, and I should say they organized in communities across the South, especially close to battlefields or large hospital complexes where there would have been large numbers of dead soldiers who had been interred. Their primary goal was to create national Confederate cemeteries. The federal government was taking care of that responsibility for Union soldiers. There was a federal burial crew that was both in the North and in the South, scouting for and then creating national Union cemeteries. But the women took up this obligation in the South.
Maybe I misspoke. I said it really wasn't about the dead. I thought it was more about the lost cause.
Well, it was about the lost cause. The lost cause is the romantic interpretation of the Confederacy. And there are several tenets to the lost cause, and this is what develops. This is how former Confederates explain the war to themselves and to their children and future generations after the war. Well, one of the chief components of the lost cause was that the war was not about slavery. Instead, they used the vague reference to states' rights. There were also other components, such as General Lee being the greatest general. Things like Confederate men weren't defeated on the battlefield. They were simply overwhelmed by military odds that they could have never competed with the resources and the men that the Union had. Now, some aspects of the lost cause do have some truth to them, but this is the very romantic explanation of why the Confederate cause did not succeed.
So there they were then, trying to create Confederate cemeteries and also promote the idea of the lost cause. When did the Union get in on the idea of a Memorial Day?
Well, I should say that the ladies started this spontaneously in communities throughout the South in the spring of 1866. It wasn't until May 30th of 1868 that the Union's Veterans Association, the Grand Army of the Republic, designated May 30th as the day that all Union dead would be remembered. So 2 years after.
Now, is that the one that was called Decoration Day?
Well, both of them are called Decoration Day at different points, both Confederate and union. What would happen was the opposite side would refer to, they would refer to the opposite side as Decoration Day. So, for example, ladies in the South would refer to their celebrations, their days as Memorial Day, and refer to union celebrations as Decoration Day, and vice versa.
So obviously then, the differences were perpetuated to some extent by the way that the Memorial War was thought about in different places. Tell us about the importance of women, very particularly, calling attention to the lost cause and to the dead soldiers of the Confederacy. Why the women and not the men?
Well, it was essential that white women in the South did this because they were seen during the mid-19th century. Women were seen as apolitical or not political. They weren't believed to be involved in partisan politics. Obviously, they didn't have the vote. And both Confederate men and women recognized that women would be better suited to take the lead in memorializing the lost cause and this lost Confederate cause because women, not being political as they were thought of, their actions, therefore, would not be considered treasonous to the United States government. Had veterans, had Confederate veterans done this, it would have been seen as treasonous. So it's essential that memorial days and reinterment ceremonies were under the direction of ladies because these provided the legitimate venues for ex-Confederate veterans to march into towns because Memorial Day always had a procession, a parade. It allowed thousands of white Southerners to gather in a central location, sometimes as many as 60,000, and for former Confederate generals and political figures to praise the Confederate cause in a public forum. All the while, Confederates, both men and women, are claiming that these were simply the spontaneous tributes of mothers and daughters in mourning. So, in short, they believed women's gender protected them from Northern retaliation. Men might be arrested, women would not.
That's really remarkable history, and it gives you an idea of how bitter the differences were between the North and the South as well, when the men were worried about being treated as treasonous if they memorialized their war dead. We're talking with Carolyn Janey, who's an assistant professor at Purdue University. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, we're going to be talking about updating the GI Bill in the United States Senate last week and the repercussions in the presidential campaign. In a moment, we'll be back with this special edition of To the Point on Memorial Day.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, still talking with Professor Carolyn Janey at Purdue University about the history of Memorial Day. Bring us up, if you will, a little closer to the present. After World War I, there was a much more unified national celebration of Memorial Day, as I understand it.
Right. Actually, we could look back to the 1880s to see a more unified Memorial Day. Maybe we could even talk about it as being a split Memorial Day, in that by the 1880s, when Confederate and Union veterans are starting to come together in reunions at places like Gettysburg in 1887, what's happening is they're attending each other's Memorial Days. So men might come from Philadelphia, Union veterans from Philadelphia might travel to Richmond and attend Confederate Memorial Day, and vice versa. The men from Richmond might go to Philadelphia and attend National Memorial Day. What happened during this period is that it becomes depoliticized in the sense that the veterans agree not to talk about the issues of the war, primarily slavery, but to commend the bravery and honor of soldiers on both sides. And then when you have the Spanish-American War in 1898, and especially World War I, then Memorial Days come to encompass dead from both regions and are therefore no longer exclusively about celebrating Civil War soldiers.
When did the date get changed from always being on May 30th to what it is now?
1971 is when the federal law is passed that declares the last Monday of May to be Memorial Day.
You think it ought to be moved back to May 30th?
Sure, why not? We celebrate July 4th as the founding of the country. Absolutely, May 30th would make a lot more sense.
Carolyn Janney, again, a professor of history at Purdue University. Her book, Burying the Dead But Not the Past, Ladies' Memorial Associations and the Lost Cause. Fascinating history. This, of course, is Memorial Day 2008. Let's bring it up to date with Jim Sheeler, who's Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Rocky Mountain News. He's been covering the war in Iraq from the home front for 5 years. He has expanded that coverage into a book called Final Salute, A Story of Unfinished Lives. Jim Sheeler, good to have you with us.
Thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
You did an extraordinary thing with this book, and it went on for a long, long time, following a Marine casualty notifications officer, Major Beck, a practice, interestingly enough, of having somebody go to the homes of dead veterans, dead soldiers, that was begun during Vietnam.
Right, right, and with the beginning of this war, it's expanded, and they're still kind of, I think, figuring it out. Major Beck was a Marine that I met. Who I was about 2 years into reporting the war, and by that time I had, you know, been to dozens of funerals, and kind of seen how the Marines act and react differently than they do on the in the movies and the recruiting posters. You know, they don't have that blank stare when they're folding their buddy's flag for the last time. So. I decided to try and get in with them and get a sense of how everything worked from the point of the knock to years on with the families. And in following Major Beck, I learned that it's just as hard on the Marines a lot of times. Well, not just as hard, it can't be. But it's incredibly difficult on the notification officers who are tasked with that duty. A lot of them say they would rather be in Iraq than having to walk up to that porch not knowing what's on the other side of that door. Sometimes they're met with screams or anger. Sometimes they're met with hugs. But they say the most trying times of their life. You know, trying to figure out, you know, how to make that knock and what to say next.
Did this change Major Beck over the 2 years that you were with him?
I think it did. You know, he originally, like a lot of the Marines I met, was anxious to go to war. That once their buddies are over there, they all want to be there with them fighting. And he was frustrated that he was still back at home. And then when these notifications started happening, I think he realized that with his upbringing and his background, that he was pretty uniquely qualified to care for these families, and he did it in a way that he said he would have cared for his own mother, you know, if she were still alive, or his own sister, if he had to notify them. And he really took it one step further than a lot of the casualty manuals require. You know, the list of procedures is very bureaucratic. And what he did was really insert humanity into it and care for these families so that he would be bringing, you know, the boxes of their things, their son's things, to their homes afterwards and going through them. And I think he realized that even though he wasn't in Iraq, his duty here turned out to be just as important. These families still look up to him and still call him with requests and sometimes just to talk.
Jim Sheeler at the Rocky Mountain News, the book Final Salute, A Story of Unfinished Lives. One of the most touching stories I've ever heard is the story that you tell in that book about the pregnant woman that you picked up and met 3 days after her notification that her husband had been killed. Tell us about her.
Sure. Catherine Cathy. She was 7 months pregnant at the time, and she had just learned of her husband's death, and then a day before we were there, she had learned that the baby would be a boy. But she talked about, you know, we came over to learn about Jim's life, and that's one of the constants is all of these families want to talk about their loved one. They want the media to be able to put their son's picture on the front page, and Catherine was no different. She let us in, and we talked for hours, up almost until midnight, until At one point, she brought out this baby blanket, and she said, when Jim was at officer candidate school, he was gone all the time, so she started knitting. And when Jim left for Iraq, he knew he wouldn't be home in time to see the baby born because his deployment would take 7 months. But he wanted to leave the baby something before he left. And so the last night that he was there, he slept with that baby blanket that Catherine had made, because when the baby was born, he wanted the baby to know how he smelled. And for me, that was just about all I needed to know about Jim Cathy. In fact, my lead on the story the next day was the soft blue-green baby blanket still smells like Second Lieutenant James J. Cathy. I think that it allowed me in many ways as well to gain a new respect for a lot of these service members. You realize that, you know, they are built to, you know, fight and kill and break down doors and blow stuff up, but at the same time, there are these amazing, touching moments with them and the families afterwards that just really tear at your heart. There was another.
But before you go to another one, sure. What happened when Cathy, when her husband's body came home?
Sure, we met her at the. We met his body at the airport, and after he was taken to the funeral home, she decided that she didn't want him to be left alone, and so she asked that the Marines watch over him 24 hours a day. Usually, the Marines will only will guard the body, basically posting at the head and the foot of the casket whenever it's accessible to the public. But then, when it's once the casket is inside the mortuary or a locked, safe place, they'll leave. But Catherine asked them to watch over him 24 hours a day, so they did. And the last night before the funeral, she decided that she hadn't been able to sleep these past few nights. And this was her last chance to sleep in the same room as her husband's body. So she asked if she could. And the Marines set up a mattress in front of his casket. And that's where she slept that last night. And the Marine asked if he wanted them to continue posting watch all night, watching over her as she slept. And she said, yes, I think that's what he would have wanted.
And while she was lying in that room, you could see the street outside?
Yeah, we took a walk outside after she had fallen asleep. And, it's one of those moments where you just realize, and it's almost like one of those moments where the camera is on a tight shot and it pulls all the way back, and you just wish everybody could see what was going on in that window. I mean, it was easy to see Catherine in that window sleeping next to her husband in one of the most distilled, raw, touching moments of pure love I think I've ever seen. And yet the traffic on the road right next to us was just rushing by, and nobody stopped.
Jim Sheeler, once again, is a Pulitzer Prize winner for the Rocky Mountain News, and his book is called Final Salute, A Story of Unfinished Lives. That's just one of the stories that's in that book. Michael Sledge is a freelance writer. He's author of Soldier Dead, How We Recover, Identify, Bury, and Honor Our Military Fallen. He joins us from Shreveport, Louisiana. And Michael Sledge, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
How would you generalize about the way in which we as a nation are recognizing, honoring, to use your term in your book, our military fallen?
Well, you know, as the two previous speakers have indicated, we've made tremendous strides in the individual recognition like that. And but I think we've gotten a little bit away from our national recognition that we do. The good example is moving Memorial Day to the Monday, so you can have a 3-day holiday so everybody can, you know, continue their festivities rather than have it fall on whatever day it happened to fall on. I think nationally, we've kind of lost for several reasons, we've lost the national ability to really grieve. Now, we talk about recognition, we talk about remembrance, we talk about memorials, but nationally grieving, I think we have two things working against us as far as to do that. And one reason is because, again, it's when we have the holiday. But the second reason is the fact that our military draws from a much smaller percentage of the population than it used to. and almost like the professional soldiers. And so we, you know, take our hat off at the ball game, and we have the national anthem. We, you know, we listen to a quick speech, and then we're done. Let's go back to getting out on the boat, as opposed to really grieving like that. And you see a lot of the speeches, if you really, you know, go through and parse a lot of the speeches that are given, you see a lot of individual heroism. You know, he died for his country. They recite a letter to the parents. But if you look back at previous speeches, they don't really do that. As a matter of fact, they not only don't use the individual names like that, they actually speak beyond just the war itself and actually go to the sanctity of life, the preciousness of life, and how passion drives people, passion and a belief drive people to put themselves in these situations at risk like that. And we speak to a much broader sphere of humanity when we open the picture up, as Jim was talking about, to not just see that one thing right there before us, but to see the whole reason. You know, why do we do this? And what are the results? And I'd like to see us get back to a little bit more generalization, so to speak, I think was the word you used, to understand that we're losing lives here. Yes, the loss for patriotism. Yes, the loss in battle. Yes, the loss in, very specifically, let's drill right down to Iraq and Afghanistan. But, you know, this is a tremendous thing that had happened right here. And I think we should all actually, rather than just memorialize it, we should actually grieve for it and not wish we could maybe reverse what happened, but we need to really take it to heart. And I think the first step on that would be to put Memorial Day back on the day it belongs.
Still with us is Professor Janie at Purdue University. You, too, wanted to put the day back where it belongs. Compare it to the 4th of July.
I do. If July 4th is the day that we celebrate as the birth of our nation, I think we need to look to Memorial Day. And I agree with Michael Sledge that it needs to be a day, a national day, not only of grieving, but I guess I would add on to what he says in terms of a national day of celebrating the nation that we still have and thinking of it not as the birth of our country but as the continual rebirth of our nation, whether that be through the Civil War or subsequent wars as well.
Yeah, Michael Sledge, that makes sense to you?
Yes, it does. It really does. And this is the sort of thing that we need to have. I don't know, maybe we need the college professors to maybe write some of the speeches instead of the political speech writers, you know.
Well, that might be an improvement. I wonder, when you say that, I think the poetry and the passion has somewhat gone out of the way we memorialize it. Doesn't that have something to do with the unpopularity of the engagement we're in at the moment? And wasn't that also true in Vietnam, even though in Vietnam we had the draft and we had a larger proportion of the population was involved?
Well, I don't have any statistics, any data available to judge the current unpopularity of the, and I'll separate the war in Iraq versus the war in Afghanistan, because my opinion is that there's two distinctly opinions as far as those two conflicts like that. But certainly there was a lot of conflict in Vietnam, not so much at the beginning, but then later on.
Michael Sledge, I'm going to interrupt you. I asked you a question too close to the time that we have to go to a break. So let me ask you to interrupt what you're saying. We'll let you continue, and we'll continue this conversation later as well. And on our notebook, we'll talk about the updating of the GI Bill and how that affected the presidential campaign. On To the Point.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with this special Memorial Day edition of To the Point. We're talking with Michael Sledge, whose book is Soldier Dead, How We Recover, Identify, Bury, and Honor Our Military Fallen. You were just making a distinction between the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq in terms of public support. And what I had asked was whether or not the ability to grieve as a nation, indivisible as it were, has declined because of the unpopularity of the war. And also, let me just add to that the fact that the Bush administration has not allowed what did happen in Vietnam, which was televised photographs of the coffins coming back from the war zone. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's very important. I'm glad you mentioned that, Warren. That policy of not viewing the return of the dead at Dover Air Force Base actually initiated with the first President Bush during the Gulf War.
Oh, okay.
And it continued through all administrations since. Now, you just this is a very complex issue because many people get it wrong because they sometimes phrase the question, should we view the bodies coming back? The answer is we never viewed the bodies. We only viewed the transfer cases that they came in. They're not even in coffins or caskets at that point in time. But so and this issue is because the question is not phrased correctly, I think the administration, all administrations are allowed to spin that to their purpose because a defense official told me that, I'm going to paraphrase, we got hit over the head by all the photographs of the dead in Vietnam and we want to make damn sure it doesn't happen again. And so, you know, there's no question that all administrations have wanted to control the viewing of the transfer cases of the dead as they come back, because at that point in time, they're still anonymous. They're not even officially identified then. So we can't say that the family doesn't want it because, one, there's never been a poll of the family, and some family members do want it. Two, there aren't really any family members' remains or bodies or loved ones yet because they haven't been officially identified. They're still the country's anonymous fallen soldiers, and we should be able to photograph those as they're offloaded for final processing at Dover. But Oliver Wendell Holmes, in one of his famous speeches, he was talking about the fact that it's important that we understand and that on Memorial Day we give recognition to the passion and the belief that men die for. He didn't draw a distinction between the North and the South. In fact, he even went so far as to say that the North believed one thing, the South believed another. What he said was it was important that men, and this, of course, now would be women, of course, that people follow their passion, and if they believe in something, they'd be willing to make the ultimate sacrifice to do so, because if they don't do that, they'll be in, this is, quote, peril of being judged not to have lived. So this is what I was speaking about, is the fact that we really can't look to the popularity or not of this particular war, because if we speak on a general scale, we're not going to worry if the war is popular or not. We're going to be grieving and memorializing the sacrifices that these people have made for that which they believed in or for that which they signed up for, because you can't just put it on a scale and say, well, we're going to start having these national services if 60% of the... We can't put that on a public opinion poll.
Michael Sledge, again, excuse me for interrupting. A Soldier Dead, How We Recover, Identify, Bury, and Honor Our Military Fallen. I just want to move on because we have a couple of other people we want to hear from. Earlier, we heard about Major Beck, the Marine who gets so involved with the families with whom he has to give the worst kind of news that they could possibly hear. Not everybody is satisfied with the way that the military is handling the return of dead soldiers or the announcement of their deaths or the reports of what happened to them. Nadia McCaffrey is the founder of the Sergeant Patrick McCaffrey Foundation for War Veterans, inspired by the loss of her own son in Iraq on June 22, 2004. She is in Tracy in Northern California. Nadia McCaffrey, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It took you 2 years to get the Pentagon to give you the official report of your son's death. Tell us what you heard at first and what you finally were able to discover.
Well, yes. I was told the day after his death, that my son was killed in an ambush by insurgent in Balad on June 22, 2004. And basically, that's all I have been told. But, of course, when the soldier from Patrick's unit returned home, they contacted me, and even before this, by email, I already knew that that was not the case, that his death was very different than what I was told.
What were the circumstances of his death?
Well, first of all, Patrick was a National Guard. He was not a soldier per se. He enlisted after 9/11 as a reaction to it and found himself in Iraq. He was 34 years old with two children. What happened to him, he was patrolling with another soldier, actually two other American soldiers, and they were followed by five Iraqi trainees from the Iraqi army, not attached to our army. Anyway, they were training them. And for this, you have to understand, also happens just after Abu Ghraib. So the attitude and the trust between American and Iraqi had changed. So these five trainees were behind the three American soldiers, and they ambushed them, basically, and shot. My son was shot 8 times, and Lieutenant Tyson was next to him, was shot 1 round in the head, and the third soldier survived by miracle because he rolled into a ditch, and the ditch happened to be a dry canal, which, you know, saved his life, basically. He was severely wounded, but he survived it.
So the circumstances were very different then from what you were originally told.
Yes.
Did you finally get the Pentagon to confirm the story that you just told us? And let me say, I think everyone who is listening to this and to listening to you is very sympathetic to you for the loss of your son. So let me make sure that that I acknowledge that. And I think on behalf of all our listeners, I want to make sure that you know that. Go ahead. Did the Pentagon finally confirm it?
Well, you realize that from day one, I wanted to know everything. Patrick was my only child. I wanted to know everything. We were very close, and I wanted to know everything about his death, about how, you know, everything around surrounding his death. So, of course, I started to ask questions immediately. And by the way, after his body returned or was sent from Dover to Sacramento Airport in California, I asked the media to be present for his return. And because of this gesture, Patrick was already well known as a soldier. This was like a fire. It just covered all the news there was at the time. So I'm saying this because they already know who I was at the time. And when I didn't receive answers directly from the Pentagon and everywhere else that I contacted and talked with, I approached our senator, Senator Boxer, and told her, you know, I need to know. I just need to know. She responded immediately by writing to the Pentagon. And exactly 1 month later, I received a visit of General Hillman, along with three high-rank officers. They came here to Tracy, to the house, to deliver personally the official report of Patrick's death, and the autopsy report, explaining to me in details how my son was killed.
Were they able to tell you why it was that you were initially told that he was ambushed by insurgents, which is certainly a distorted version of what happened?
Yes. Well, there is no clear answer, but another thing we need to realize that this, again, was 2004. This was a time where General Petraeus was telling us that everything was under control with the Iraqi army. They were just about ready to take over, of SO1. Everything was going according to plan. And then this happened. So, of course, I don't believe that this was a good thing to say on a wire nationally that, you know, that this happened. So I believe that it's because of that. And when I asked General Hillman, you know, he said, well, we have no excuses, and they definitely apologized, you know, over and over. But why wait 2 years? I was never given an answer for that.
Nadia McCaffrey, founder of the Sergeant Patrick McCaffrey Foundation for War Veterans, speaking to us from Tracy, California. Let me go back to Jim Sheeler with the Rocky Mountain News and refer to your book, Final Salute, A Story of Unfinished Lives. This is a pretty different kind of story from what we heard from you about Major Beck, and I'm just interested in your take on it. Obviously, the Army is different from the Marines, but are you surprised to hear this?
No, I'm not. Obviously, you know, if you take Pat Tillman as the most well-known case, that you know, there have been mistakes.
The professional football player who was in fact shot by friendly fire and was after his family had been told something else. Go ahead.
Yep, exactly. And I mean that especially his case has spurned you know, reviews of both the casualty notification process, how families are told of their, you know, exactly what happened in the death of the service member. And I think that most all branches would admit that at the beginning of the war they were unprepared for the number of casualties and how they were going to deal with all of these families. It's just staggering when you think of the number of families that are touched. I mean, one name goes across that screen, and there are hundreds of people who are affected. When somebody dies, and so, you know, when you think of these service members, and I think Michael really touched, you know, hit it on the head there when he was saying about the emotional involvement, and that goes with the Marines, with Major Beck as well. He believes that everybody, the American public, should have this emotional involvement, and it doesn't matter what your views on the war are, but as a country, we need to feel that we're at war. And you know, when the planes do come in, the soldiers' bodies used to be brought in on commercial airlines, and we were allowed to film take pictures and be there on the tarmac with the family because the family gave us permission to be there on the tarmac when the bodies were unloaded. And you can see the passengers' faces that, you know, they may have been coming to Reno to go gambling or have a good time for the weekend, and all of a sudden they see this scene of this grieving pregnant widow and the Marines taking a flag-draped casket off of their plane, and they realize that they've just become part of the war. And now most of the soldiers are brought back in private jets. And Major Beck says that he has kind of mixed feelings about that, because it once again distances the public from being part of the war, of having that part of that grieving process as a nation that Michael was talking about.
Jim Shiller, again, at the Rocky Mountain News. We've heard about the families and the problems that families have. We talked about the possibility of a broader, more universal kind of reaction to memorialization of war dead. Alex Horton is a senior advisor for VoteVets.org, which is a nonpartisan group that looks after the rights of active duty officers. He's currently in the active reserves, continues to write a blog, which is armyofdude.blogspot.com. He's in Austin, Texas. And Alex Horton, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What about those who are in the Army, in the Marines, in other services, and see their comrades killed? Do we pay enough attention to them?
I think we do. As far as the public goes, you really don't have a chance to see those inward and outward changes, and you know, the personality and everyday lives of service members that are affected by their comrades being killed. Certainly, within the military, there is a deep respect for, you know, all the soldiers that are killed, because when it's all said and done, these are our comrades and as close as brothers. So, within the military, yes. Outside of it, not so much.
So compare then what it's like to lose a friend in the Army, a buddy in the Army, as opposed to losing a friend to cancer or an automobile accident or something of that kind in civilian life.
When people have a hard time wrapping their head around is life in combat is a very, very simple, stripped down experience. And, you know, you just think in terms of life and death and eating and being around your friends, it's very, I hesitate to call it worry-free, but you don't have to worry about your car payments or your kids or your wife or anything like that. And so when you spend, you know, 24 hours a day with your fellow soldiers and then the next day they're not there, it's incredibly devastating because when it's all said and done, the mission is to bring everyone back home alive. And when one soldier is killed, that's a failure of that mission. So, you know, everyone is deeply affected by it, not only because it brings down the level of efficiency, but, you know, you've lost someone you've served with for years, and it hits home incredibly hard.
I'm just interested in your reaction to what we've heard from our other guests, particularly from the idea, and I think you reflected it yourself, that although we may recognize on an individual basis what's happening, we don't do so very well as a society. Elaborate a little bit on your feelings about that.
Well, I think Canada really does put us to shame, for lack of a better term, in the recognition of war dead. In Ontario, Canada, they have what's called the Highway of Heroes that goes from Trenton, Ontario to Toronto. And it's all the casualties coming in from the Canadian Army in Afghanistan. And when the caskets arrive, they're transported along this particular strip. And along the whole way, traffic completely stops. You got police cruisers and ambulances that are notified ahead of time, and overpasses, and you know, along the highway, traffic completely stops for miles and miles as these caskets move from Trenton to Toronto, and everyone gets out of their cars and they give a salute or they hold their hand over their hearts. And to my knowledge, there's nothing like that in the States. As the previous guests have explained, you know, they're coming in on private jets, and no one really sees these war dead, so it, you know, it's a second thought to them.
And I should say that's in a country, Canada, where there's a good deal of opposition to having troops in Afghanistan, and yet they still manage, as a society you're suggesting, or at least in a very public way, to recognize what's happening.
I mean, they see it as a nonpartisan thing. I mean, you know, a lot of people are opposed to the war in Afghanistan. They think it's America's war. But, you know, they still recognize and honor and respect the war dead as something, you know, more noble than themselves. And I give them the great credit for that.
I forgot to mention, forgot to tell our listeners, you had two friends who died in combat. Is Memorial Day, is it a special day for you?
I almost call it any other day because there's not a day or an hour that goes by when I don't think about my two friends that are killed and the sacrifices they had to make and their family. You know, being a combat veteran, you live with the war every day, you know, when it's not on the news or not. You know, it's just a part of you. So, you know, on Memorial Day, I might, you know, give my friends a call and talk about old times. But every day is remembering, you know, what we went through and those who unfortunately didn't make it back.
Well, Alex Horton, again, senior advisor for VoteVets.org, blogging at armyofdude.blogspot.com in Austin, Texas. Our sympathies to you. Thanks very much for being with us. Everybody remembers in a different way on Memorial Day. Nadia McCaffrey, thank you to you. Thanks to you, founder of the Sergeant Patrick McCaffrey Foundation for War Veterans. Michael Sledge, author of Soldier Dead, How We Recover, Identify, Bury, and Hold and Honor Our Military Fallen. And Jim Sheeler at the Rocky Mountain News, his book, Final Salute, A Story of Unfinished Lives. Thank you all very much for being with us. Last Thursday, the U.S. Senate updated the GI Bill with $2 billion worth of new education benefits for veterans. John McCain was against the measure, which precipitated a nasty exchange between him and Barack Obama. We'll have more on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. John McCain comes from a military family. He's considered a war hero by political friends and foes. He's a natural ally of America's veterans. A new GI Bill was sponsored by two other Vietnam veterans, Democrat Jim Webb of Virginia and Nebraska Republican Chuck Hagel. But McCain said it was too expensive. He had a different version. Friday, the Webb-Hagel bill passed with the support of Barack Obama. Gordon Lubold is a Pentagon correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gordon, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What was in Senator McCain's bill? How was it different from the one that passed?
Well, there are two central issues and differences of opinion. The issue of transferring the benefit to another family member is the primary thing that Senator McCain's bill has that Senator Webb doesn't. And then the other issue is that length of time that you need to serve before the benefit kicks in, 6 years versus 3 years, is the other issue. Senator McCain feels that you should be in the service longer before the benefit kicks in.
Longer because he feared, as I understand it, that there might be incentives if you only had to serve 3 years for people to get out of the service.
Right. You know, what's interesting here is that the GI Bill originally was designed to help transition, you know, so many service members out of the military into civil society, civilian society. Now, there with these wars and the overstretched military and the army with repeated deployments, the issue is attracting good people but keeping them. And so the concern is that, and the Pentagon's concern initially was that if you have too nice of a bill, too generous, potentially you start to lose people too quickly.
And the GI Bill, of course, goes back to World War II when we had the draft, and a lot of people were serving and then had to make a transition back into a civilian life in a situation where they had no choice in the matter at all.
No, and Senator Webb, as you mentioned, the primary sponsor was Chuck Hagel, and also Senator Warner, all GI Bill beneficiaries, who said that they wouldn't be where they are today without the bill.
Has the McCain position on this damaged him that you can tell with the veterans groups?
You know, it's an interesting issue because for a long time he was essentially not supporting the Webb bill that everybody else was lining up in favor of, and it wasn't really clear why. And then the Pentagon kind of came out and said a little bit more about why they thought the Webb bill wasn't quite right for them, and then Senator McCain introduced his legislation. You know, whether it hurts or not, he has to make a compelling case that there's a policy difference. It's a legitimate one, and he's really trying to help support veterans and the troops generally, but do it intelligently and do it responsibly. But it's a real, you know, it's everybody wants to do the right thing for veterans, but now it's become a bit of a dogfight as to, you know, how to do it and how much.
Gordon Lubold, once again, Pentagon correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Well, here's what happened in the U.S. Senate. Senator Obama said he respects Senator McCain's military service, but then he says, "I can't believe why he believes it's too generous to our veterans. I couldn't disagree with him and the president, who said the same thing, more on this issue. There are many issues that lend themselves to partisan posturing, but giving our veterans the chance to go to college should not be one of them." McCain then responded. He wasn't there to vote on the bill, but he responded in writing this way: "Perhaps if Senator Obama would take the time and trouble to understand this issue, he would learn to debate an honest disagreement respectfully, but as he always does, he prefers impugning the motives of his opponent, exploiting a thoughtful difference of opinion to advance his own ambitions. If that is how he would behave as president, the country would regret his election." So this is right in the middle of what is becoming a very contentious argument between those two men.
Yeah, really strong wording there by Senator McCain. You know,
pretty strong wording by Senator Obama, too.
Yeah, absolutely. But both men have to be extremely careful here because of, as I said, you know, everybody wants to do the right thing for veterans, but they both have to be careful not to go too far to be seen by the population, by voters, by veterans as working for political purposes. Obviously, this is always the case, but, you know, Senator McCain certainly has the bona fides on military issues. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that he is going to be right. On the other hand, Senator Obama, who really doesn't have that experience and really probably doesn't have as much of depth of knowledge on those issues, has to, you know, be careful to respect the fact that there may be a legitimate case made for protecting the service, protecting the military, and making sure that you're not doing something to undermine the strength of the Defense Department.
And again, as an illustration of just how tough the language is getting, here's Senator Obama in Michigan. He said John McCain has called for $300 to $400 billion worth of corporate tax breaks. But he can't afford $2 billion to provide our GIs the kind of education they need. Doesn't make any sense. Senator McCain responding to, I don't have it in front of me, but to the effect that a guy who has never put on the uniform of his nation has no business criticizing somebody who has. So it would appear that there's increasing bitterness, and this may go on for a while. And certainly, as you point out, the veterans are going to be listening.
Right. I think, you know, Senator McCain, you know, who aligned himself with the surge of troops in Iraq, a very brave move since he was essentially swimming upstream against a lot of his colleagues. You know, and now that the surge of troops was credited with much of the success on the ground in Iraq. At the same time, you know, he in this general election will have to distance himself from the Bush White House. You know, veterans were perceived that the White House made a mess of the Defense Department, and the uniforms will be the ones, you know, stuck there cleaning it up long after, you know, Bush moves back to Texas.
Very quickly, what about Senator Clinton on this issue? She voted for the same bill Senator Obama voted for. Does she have anything to say on the floor of the Senate?
I'm not sure exactly what she may have said on the floor, but I think that she, like so many, it's easy to support this bill. And as I said, you know, Senator Warner, respected Republican from Virginia, also a veteran, you know, so many people support doing the right thing. It's just it's getting past all these kind of headlines and getting to the nitty gritty of what is best really for the Defense Department and veterans, okay, and weighing them appropriately.
Well, Gordon Leubold, thanks very much for being on our program.
Thanks for having me again. Happy Memorial Day.
Same to you. Pentagon correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Sonia Geis, Dan Konecki, and Gary Scott. Technical director, Mike Newport. Managing producer, Carolyn Radziner. Thanks to the John Coltrane family. For more information about To the Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To the Point. I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International. And on this Memorial Day, our best to you.
PRI, Public Radio International.